we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Episode 57, are we? It's just you and me, Mark. How are you?
Ooh, yeah, I'm super bad. I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm recovering from the whole Dell EMC thing. Thanks for being on the podcast that we kind of rushed together, like I said, scrambling a squad of F-16s or something. That was trying to get a podcast out.
Yeah, but it was the thing to do, right? It's really kind of fun, you know, jumping in, and you're over your heads because there's things you don't understand, and it's, you know, stuff is changing. So I guess we'll get to do a little bit of corrections now today.
Yeah, you know what? I reckon those corrections will be coming for a long time as well, because I think this thing is going to ebb and flow for a very long time, I think.
Yeah, you got that right. Yeah.
I mean, there's a few other things to talk about today. Not a lot, actually, but I just thought we did put out the episode earlier on in the week as kind of like In Tech We Trust special edition, I think we called it, just talking for the whole show about the whole Dell EMC thing. It's been a couple of days since that went out. It's been pretty popular, actually, so thanks, everybody, for listening to it. I'm just wondering if you've had any, I don't know, if you've had any other thoughts on it now that it's had a chance to settle.
It's kind of almost like having a death. Right. I was depressed and down for a couple of days. I mean, you know, we said it before. I'll say it again. EMC is the leader in this industry, you know, and has been for a long time. And I guess I just, you know, the way I look at it is I don't give it much hope, or I think a lot of things about EMC are going to probably stop functioning the way they have in the past. And that's a little bit depressing, you know, for starters. Now I'll probably never go to work for EMC, you know, because, you know, I've got like 60 days or something. Well, probably longer than that. Who knows when this deal closes?
Why are you thinking about putting in a rival bid?
I mean, there you go. There is a really interesting question, you know, because HP came out and they said this is outrageously expensive. But, you know, I guess Donatelli's not there anymore to say, well, we've got to beat down Dell for this deal,
mm-hmm.
right? And Meg probably won't do that. But, I mean, HP has to be looking at, just like all the other big companies, you know, what do we do and how do we deal with this? Maybe it's not out of the question for another company to come in and say, we're going to make a different offer.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I might be showing my naivety here, right? But I remember some of the previous deals that have gone ahead. One that actually, were you at 3PAR? You were, weren't you, when they were bought by HP?
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was part of that deal.
So I remember with that deal and with other deals, quite often what happened was other potential suitors came in and it kind of pushed the price up and there was a bit of a bidding war went on. Now, I don't know if the numbers are just too huge here for that kind of thing to happen. I don't know, actually.
Well, I think the numbers are really huge, but I think what you want to look at is how else would somebody like try to structure this deal? You know, I don't know that nobody's got this kind of cash lying around. I mean, the estimates for what it's going to cost, you know, Dell's going to have to raise between 40 and 50 billion, right? And that's all over the map, and nobody knows what it's going to be. And nobody knows what the cost of that money is going to be either, right? So, you know, like when the news first came out and they said it's a $67 billion deal, then I saw other stuff that was, you know, it's a $62 billion deal. It could be more than that. And it has to do with, you know, what it costs Dell to borrow this money and what the value of the tracking stock of VMware is.
Right? Yeah.
And, you know, to me, that whole tracking stock thing, it looks like a ruse. You know, here you got a private company that's going to own 80% of, you know, supposedly a public company. That's a joke in of itself.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, and then so they're going to allow, you know, 19%. It's actually not 80%. It's 81%. So then there, you know, so there's another 19% of people that own, you know, of shareholders of VMware. But then on that 80% that is Dell, a private company, owns, they're creating a stock that people can trade in that reflects the value of what Dell owns. I mean,
yeah.
Why is that interesting to anybody?
And I don't think it is, judging on some of the reactions that I've read, but I believe that they had to do it. Now, I'm no financial expert here, but I believe that they had to do it to avoid an $8 billion tax bill. I don't know if that's come up in any of the research that you've done.
I have looked at that. Yeah,
yeah.
I've looked
so
at that.
I kind of understand why Dell would want to do it from that perspective. Of course, well, I mean, you know, what the heck's 8 billion when you're already raising 50 billion of debt, right? It's not, but you know, jokes aside, it is a massive number. So I can see why Dell would want to do that. But if I was an EMC stockholder at the moment and I was going to be getting this tracking stock rather than proper stock, I think I'd be a little bit peeved, to be honest.
Yeah, and you know, it looks like the way VMware stock is traded, I haven't looked at it today to see if it's down more, and the way EMC stock is traded, right? A lot of times, you know, when you see these announcements of an acquisition, the stock gets bid up to close to what the acquiring price is. Mm-hmm. In this case, the EMC stock is hanging down below the acquisition price, you know, somewhere around $33 a share.
Yeah.
And that's because, and the way it's been explained to me is because they don't believe that the tracking stock is worth that much.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things. It's a market. It's something is worth what people are willing to pay. Dell went out on a limb there, you know, and said, well, we think people will be willing to pay this much. Well, the market's going to tell them what they're willing to pay. And then what happens? Do they need to borrow more money? Oh, you know, it looks to me like they're going to have to, oh, that's the thing, right? That's why the amount of money they're going to have to borrow and what their whole debt burden going forward is a fluid thing.
Yeah. Hey, Mark, just backing up a little bit. Did you see this coming, this acquisition by Dell, or were you like properly blindsided by it?
Pretty much blindsided by it, right? I mean, there's been discussion about HP doing it for a long time. I always thought that, you know, and then it's a question is who buys who, you know, and does HP buy EMC? Does EMC buy HP? What goes on there, right? And it's always kind of laughable. And, you know, and then there was the thing about, you know, VMware buying EMC.
Right, yeah.
Or you know, maybe EMC buying all of VMware outright and then renaming the company VMware and all different kinds of machinations, that kind of thing. I didn't see this. I particularly did not see Dell because they're already up to their necks in debt. I mean, you could say, oh, all they've got in debt right now, and it's an estimate because they're a private company and nobody really knows for sure what it is, right? And, you know, say, well, it's down to 10 or it's up to 14. Well, that's a big difference and no one knows. And I just didn't think that they were going to, you know, that they were going to try to do this.
Right. Yeah.
And furthermore, just because you can put a bunch of friends together and raise this kind of money doesn't mean that you're going to be able to run it.
No, it doesn't.
And that's a message to you, Michael Dell. You, if you are listening to this, I don't think you are going to be able to run this mess. So fine. Congratulations on getting this deal put together, but good luck, pal.
Yeah, I don't know how the guy sleeps at night at the moment, actually. I keep thinking to myself, is it one of those where, like, should we try this? Should we try this? And then, like, oh my goodness, it's actually happened. Okay. Now we have to actually go and execute, and that's the big thing.
Hey, so Nigel, I told you, you know, what I was thinking, and then we, you know, went down a rat hole. But what are your thoughts about this? You know, in 2 days since Monday, where are you at with it?
Yeah, you know, I think probably quite similar. I think main thought is we could be at the end of an era here. I think you've already said, right, EMC is a leader in this marketplace, right? So over the last few years, we love them or hate them, right? They have been dynamic. They've been acquiring companies left, right, and center. And they have been evolving while the whole world around them has changed, right? So cloud's the big thing. We know that, right? And of all of the traditional companies, I would say they are at least on par with any of them in adapting to the cloud. They've been laser focused, if you will, right? Because I think if you take your eye off the ball at the moment, then cloud and all the whole software-defined stuff that's going on, it's just going to wipe you away. But they haven't. They've not lost their focus. They've acquired. They've transformed the business. They've, you know, rolled with the punches. I'm just concerned now that they'll lose that focus as they come to restructure and reorganize. And I'm worried that as they do that, I don't know, maybe the market can run away from them. And EMC may never be the same as they have been in the past. I mean, I get that all of the kind of positives that can potentially come from it. I don't think I really agree with any of them, to be honest. Yeah, I'm just really worried that the EMC that we've known and loved and hated, right? Because I know that I admire them as a company, right? But I'm not their hugest fan from a technology perspective. But I can't argue with the way that they've executed.
We've caught that from some of your comments in the past, Nigel.
Yeah.
Anyway, keep going. Keep going.
They've executed really well, right? And
yes.
All the changes that are going on in the industry, I think there's just the risk that they can get blown away and swept aside now. and become less dynamic and less interesting as a company, you know, become boring EMC.
I expect that to happen, actually, as part of Dell. I think the way budget processes work, you know, inside Dell and the focus on trying to cut costs and all this stuff, it will have an impact on EMC. And I think EMC will lose employees. I think there will be a attrition there, as it is with every acquisition. You know, and so how many leave immediately? How many leave before the deal closes?
Yeah.
Right? How many leave, you know, within a year of the deal closing, and how many leave within 2 years of the deal closing? And, you know, there's a certain percentage you can assign to each of those. And the question is, you know, what's the talent pool that goes out the door?
Yeah.
I think for me, Nigel, I take what you're talking about, you know, customers, you know, will migrate. And so, you know, I'll just say this, you know, so, yeah, I work for Tejal, but speaking on behalf of the rest of the startups, which includes Nimble and Pure and Tintree
and Caminario,
and who am I leaving out here, right? We're all looking at this and we're saying, yeah, so there's going to be a lot of opportunity for us to sell products in EMC's install base, flat and simple. So that's good.
Yeah.
But what worries me is that for many, many years now, this industry has defined itself by being with or against or along with or later than or before anything having to do with EMC.
Yeah.
Right? And they have been the leaders, and they're not always the first ones out with technology, but they do things, and just the way they bring it to market and the way they market. I mean, the magnificent EMC marketing budget is probably going to be cut, you know, to ribbons.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, what's going to happen with that? Who's going, you know, so who's going to carry the messages? I mean, for a long time, let's face it, everybody depended on EMC to lead this industry. And I don't think they are going to lead it anymore. And I don't see anybody else really, you know, coming to step up. IBM's kind of out of it. You know, I guess NetApp, right? NetApp all of a sudden gets to be the default number one independent storage company.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Right?
That's interesting, isn't it?
That is interesting. So that fell in their lap, but how many people want that? How many people are going to be, are looking at right now, considering the problems that NetApp has had in the last year, to say, here's our new leader? You know, no one, right?
Yeah. Well,
people at NetApp, I'm not even there, but nobody else is saying, hey, we're following NetApp around. No, that's not happening. You know, what's happening with NetApp is everyone's saying, is Cisco going to buy them?
Uh-huh. Right.
It's fascinating.
It is, yeah.
It's fascinating. So I see the whole industry, the whole storage industry, as being in crisis because of this.
Crisis is interesting, right? I mean, I think there's going to be massive, massive changes. And change is never a bad thing, right? Quite often we fear it and we don't like it. And I'm kind of, I'm very interested to see how it all pans out, I will be honest. I'm sad for EMC, not the industry in general, because I do see, like you say, all of the opportunities for the other companies now. See a chink in the armor there, get in, and it's a potential opportunity for others to flourish, where EMC, I think we're both saying we probably think they're going to flounder a little bit. So it's going to be interesting. I think the industry as well, may the shape of the industry, like you may be suggesting there, will totally change as well. And become, I don't know if it's right to say more cloud orientated, because we're kind of going down that direction already anyway. But EMC were always, you know, they were the big storage company, weren't they? And now they're going to be, albeit a big part of Dell, I don't know.
You know, and it is really interesting, of all the storage companies, who was the first storage company to talk about the change coming with cloud and how big a deal that was going to be, right? EMC.
Yeah.
And yet at this point, even though they were looking at that, and maybe they were ahead of their skis, you know, the marketing people were talking about it, but they didn't have the technology for it, but they tried. And yet, you know, you look at this deal and the cloud components in it are nil.
Mm-hmm.
And even after, you know, 3-4 years of talking about cloud and trying to be there and trying to figure out to have a way to do it, they weren't, you know, the most powerful storage company. That says a lot for the industry, right? It's you know, so NetApp, I'm sure, will say, oh, we've got cloud figured out and we're doing that, but nobody will believe it.
Yeah, as usual. Hey, Mark, I don't know if you can really say much on this, and I don't know whether it's a great question anyway, but some of the reading that I was doing, I don't know whether it was reading actually, or maybe I saw something on Twitter, but I saw a comment somewhere anyway that was talking about all of the EMC guys that have got MacBook Pros and MacBook Airs and things like that. Because, you know, they had this kind of open policy. In fact, actually, you know, Toomey, I'm sure he's probably a MacBook guy. Now that you're owned by Dell, do you think Dell come in and have this big, like, corporate mandate. It's like, you know, Dell laptops all around for everybody here. Do they come in and ruffle everybody's feathers with stuff like that? Are they a company that operates like that?
Wow.
It sounds like a pathetic thing, right? But little things matter a lot, you know, and I think they could do themselves a huge disservice if they do come in and try and, you know, shake things up like that.
Yeah. Yeah, so the EMC guys will say, if you're going to make me use that stupid Windows, give me a Microsoft Surface.
Yeah, that or like a crappy plastic Dell laptop for everybody, you know, that's going to push a few more people out the door as well. I don't know. Whatever you do, if you're listening, Michael Dell, I'm sure you're not, just don't make every... I mean, in fact, I'm sure he doesn't use a crappy Dell laptop, right?
Yeah, he doesn't use a crappy one. He uses the best machine they have. He's got a shiny machine.
Actually, you know what? Dell do some pretty decent laptops these days. I should be fair to them. Anyway, yeah. We've probably talked enough about that now. Only a couple of other things that I really wanted to mention, right? So since we're talking about cloud and stuff, Oracle, right?
Yes.
Are they up against the wall at the moment? So I noticed that their numbers haven't been great recently. I will say, if you dig down a little bit, their cloud-based numbers that they break out, they do seem to be, the cloud portion of the business does seem to be growing fairly well. But overall, it looks like Oracle are kind of struggling a bit at the moment. And I don't know how much of that is to do with cloud, right? But just for example, net income was down 20% on the same quarter last year. That's quite a big number for somebody like
Oracle.
Yeah,
that's a big number. Yeah.
And overall revenues for the quarter were down 2% as well. And 2% for Oracle is a big number as well.
It's big. 2% of a lot, of a huge number, is a lot. Yeah.
So I don't know whether it is cloud that's having an impact on them, because their own cloud numbers seem to be okay. But what, are companies opting for open source databases instead? Are people going to Microsoft and using SQL Server instead of Oracle? I don't know. They just seem to be struggling. And, you know, let's compare them to Microsoft, right, who have got new leadership, who seem to be transforming themselves, right? You know, Azure, I think by revenue, is the biggest online cloud infrastructure service or platform as a service. They're making inroads into traditional enterprises. You know, they seem to be, if you're a traditional enterprise and you're weighing up Amazon Web Services versus Microsoft Azure, I think more often than not, people would go with Microsoft Azure rather than AWS.
I'm not sure. So understand that Microsoft figures include Office 365, and that skews it quite a bit.
Is that right? So I'd not picked up on that then. Well, that could skew it quite a lot then.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot. Yeah, they kind of cheat on that basis.
That all said, though, right, Microsoft Azure, it's quite feature-rich as a cloud platform, and it's mentioned alongside AWS all the time, and I think we do tend to recognize that it's probably ahead of the Google Cloud Platform. I mean, I don't even know what Oracle's cloud platform is called.
Yeah.
And that's not a good thing for them, I don't think.
No,
you know,
I don't
think so
either.
A cloud world, right?
That's what I heard.
Maybe they didn't get the memo, I don't know. But they seem to be, I don't know whether it's just my impression of them, right, but they've never really competed that well in the storage space. I don't know, right? It all seems to be that they're quite insular. So I understand that their cloud platform is very, very much geared around their own product, their own database products and things like that, which is the total opposite of Microsoft, if I can say that, right? You know, Microsoft are all over Linux. They're all over container engines and things. You know, technologies that are not their own. They've got this massive push, Microsoft, these days, don't they, to do whatever their customers want them to do. And it seems to me that Oracle are the exact opposite of that. Their customers will do what they want them to do, and they'll try and force that.
Yeah, and Oracle's always had that relationship of trying to figure out how to milk as much as possible out of their install base.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, you know, you look at the acquisitions that they've made when they bought PeopleSoft. It was about, what else can we sell to the people that have Oracle?
Yeah.
Right? And I think their hardware acquisition is really about the same thing. How much hardware can we sell to the people that use Oracle? I think where they're having problems is that a lot of the innovation that's going on now in data processing, in databases, and in analytics is off their platform, right? It's NoSQL databases, mm-hmm. and it's Hadoop, right? And so that's, you know, people looking at doing new things with data, people looking at doing things with analytics, Oracle doesn't really have anything that's that appealing to them. And right. if Oracle had something that was appealing to them, they would charge too much for it.
Right.
So, I mean, they're stuck between, they're not stuck between a rock and a hard place. They're just at a place where the industry has moved on. They don't have the stuff that's appealing. They're, if they, you know, they charge too much for what people are paying for it these days. And, so they've got a fair amount of loyal customers still. But I'm not sure how they're going to get out of that. I just see them slowly fading out. I mean, over the years, they've been able to pick up, with the Sun acquisition, they picked up some very interesting, open source free technology that's helped them, stay sort of alive. You know, Java, imagine Java being at Oracle, right? Okay.
Yeah.
But it is. And, the question is, will they be able to compete, in NoSQL and Hadoop? And I don't see it.
You mentioned they've got a fair amount of loyal customers out there. And I know that, I've worked in my fair share of large organizations in the UK and in the financial services sector and what have you, right? And I will say, okay, I know a bunch of Oracle DBAs who are fans of the technology. They love the platform. It's their job and what have you. And they'll live and die by it, right? But as far as management and certainly C-level execs on the IT side of the business, so the likes of the CIO and what have you, not very many of them are fans of Oracle and their Oracle account manager. I'm sure I've joked about this before, right? But I've never worked for a company yet where, you've looked forward to going out for the Christmas do with your Oracle account team. but I'm serious about that. There's always this kind of underlying feeling that, they are screwing us over. They're stiffing us when it comes to maintenance and all that kind of stuff. Nobody likes contract renegotiations with Oracle. I mean, hey, it's starting to get like that with VMware, but that's a topic for another day, right? And I just wonder.
It is. And, and Microsoft and VMware have the same problem. Nobody likes their enterprise license agreements very much. Yeah.
And I'm wondering now on the Oracle side of things, right, whether that's coming around to bite them in the arse a little bit. Because, as we look to deploy services onto cloud platforms and as we look to do big data and analytics and stuff like that, nobody is really wanting to look to partner on those things with Oracle because of the way that they've been stiffed over the years by them. Now, okay, that's one guy's opinion, okay, but I will say it's born out of a moderate amount of experience.
Yeah, you've been in the trenches and you've seen that, right? I mean, the thing that keeps Oracle in business is that the stuff really works.
Yeah.
The thing about Oracle is that, yes, it is good. And the bigger the systems are and the more transactions you have to do, the better it is compared to its competition, right? And that includes Microsoft SQL Server. But, Microsoft SQL has been gaining ground, chipping away at the low end of Oracle. And Microsoft guys would argue about that. But SQL Server's a very good, mature product now. And, most of the bugs have been wrapped out of it. What's interesting is Microsoft took that SQL team and moved the most into Azure SQL. I really think there's going to be a big future of running Azure in the cloud. I question that. I believe that they probably could have kept more of those people developing, the on-prem SQL Server instead of the in-cloud SQL Server. And again, it's because I see cloud data analytics processes being more about Hadoop, being more about, NoSQL than it is about SQL.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So Microsoft whittles away a little bit, but I think Oracle's big problem is people are tired of paying that amount of money, to your point, and they can do other things on other types of systems that cost them less money. Again, it's NoSQL, eventually consistent data, which is fine for a lot of web apps, and Hadoop to get the analytics stuff going. It's like, okay, so what's the big thing? Internet of Things, right? Does Oracle help anybody with Internet of Things? No. Right. That's going to be Hadoop, or NoSQL or NoSQL. Right.
Yeah.
So the places where it's going, the ball's moved to a different place. And that high end transaction processing thing, it's still valuable. It's still really needed, but it's not where the growth is.
No, it's not.
And I don't see Oracle being able to get there. Anyway, anytime they go there, they're just going to reduce their margins. So they're kind of stuck in that. They're stuck just like, everybody else in this, just like a lot of other companies get stuck in a business. They have the legacy business that they can't. They can't compete with themselves. So there they are.
Okay. Shall we shift on? We've got one item of business kind of related news. So a company that I'll hold my hands up right and say I had never heard of before Gabriel put something on the Slack channel about them. And I'm kind of embarrassed in a way because looking at them, they've got a fair amount of cash and they fall potentially squarely into the kind of things that I'm interested in, but I didn't know anything about them anyway. Company called Bracket Computing. They've just raised, oh, I haven't got my numbers in front of me anymore, actually. In fact, actually, have I got them written down here? No, I don't. But they've raised, I think it was about $45 billion in a second round of funding, taking them up to something like $130 million.
Ooh.
Which, you know what, is a fair amount of money, actually. I mean, we talk about, you know, 10, 15 million sometimes being raised by some of the companies that we mentioned. Here's a company that's been going, I think it was since 2011, they've just raised 45 million, so they must have had about 90 million, something like that, before. And I'd never heard of them. Do you know them, Mark?
No, I didn't know it either. I was surprised with the news that Gabriel came up with, too.
So I tried to have a bit of a read through their website. I mean, we record the podcast late in the UK, so that's my excuse. Maybe I was tired, but I just got a bit bored reading it. So I'll probably do a bit of reading around them tomorrow. Maybe they'll get a mention on a future show. I did one of their diagrams on their website did look like they were providing a service that would sit on top of multiple public cloud platforms like Amazon Web Services, Google Cloud Platform, maybe Microsoft Azure in the future. And if they can provide mobility of workloads across those underlying infrastructures, they're potentially interesting. But I'm just staggered that they've raised so much money, and I'd actually never heard of them. So, shame on me.
I think they've got to be hoping for an acquisition by Amazon, Microsoft, or Google.
Certainly not EMC.
No. You know, well, you know, it's interesting. Maybe VMware will figure out how to raise some money from the depths of hell.
Yeah.
You know, what are they saying there? Bracket's computing cell builds on the elasticity, efficiency, and near infinite scale of the public cloud providers to deliver critical capabilities for enterprises to run mission-critical workloads in a multi-tenant environment. Okay.
It's a lot of buzzwords.
It's a lot of buzzwords. Multi-tenant environment, so that's, you know, I would think that's public cloud. And today they partner with Amazon Web Services and Google Cloud Platform, and it says we'll soon be adding others. So that would obviously be Azure. We're kind of not getting it. It's not... I think, you know, other people have tried to do this, and I don't know if they've been acquired or what. And I know in reading some of their news items, they were looking at, you know, security certainly important.
Yeah.
You know, so they're trying to, you know, we've talked about it, you know, before. Can anybody really, well, big enterprises really trust Google or AWS to run, you know, mission critical stuff in those clouds? And I think the answer is, well, most of that stuff is going to stay on premises because that's the way the companies want it. You know, they don't want to let their family jewels out in the cloud. So in one sense, Bracket's going after the hardest part.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's not always a recipe for success. You know, just because it's hard doesn't mean that people want to do it.
That's right. Yeah. You know, that's a really astute point, actually. It's the whole almost – remember when Violin first came into the storage market and they were going after that tier zero? And it's like a small market they're going after. Yeah. And, you know, along comes Pure and says, we'll just go for the easy sweet spot, the big market that everybody's going for. And they made a racket out of it. They've done a good job there. You aim for that really hard bit. And even if you crack it, you know what? Just because of the nature of some of your potential customers out there, even if you have got it cracked, it doesn't mean that internally they're structured and that they're open enough as an organization to even entertain it. I mean, I can see a future where public cloud offerings, you know, offer you the kind of data sovereignty and security that you need to put your crown jewels on there, but companies still won't be game to put their kit, not their kit, to put their... like you said, their crown jewels out on there, even if the platform is there. Because, I don't know, I think sometimes that senior management takes a very long time to come around to things like this. They still want to have their crown jewels where they can go and touch them in their own data centers sometimes.
Yeah, and they've already invested a lot in their data centers. And the question that says, does it make sense for us to move our data out there, take the risk that's associated with it? The risk of just having the crown jewels somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think probably the last data to go to the cloud will be that data.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know. I mean, there could be an exit there for, you know, and I'm not sure if how close this is to stuff that like Joyent was working on.
Okay. You know, Joyent, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, Joyent always impressed me as a company that was really trying to work on the high end of cloud. And, you know, where cloud's been mostly successful is in the low end commodity with AWS, you know, and to some degree, Google, right? What's the most successful thing in cloud? I don't know, probably Google Drive or, you know, that's probably wrong, but it's the cheap, really easy to access.
Yeah. I mean, I'd certainly say on the Amazon Web Services side of things, you know, S3 is, you know, where the object store, you dump stuff in there. That's really popular there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, Amazon's got, I probably said the wrong thing because I think AWS has a lot of really good creative things going on. And, you know, so for them, they've got this growing cloud business. Everything's going well. And, you know, they're finding new ways to get cloud customers with new apps. I'm not sure that there is a need for Amazon to say, oh, we want to do all this heavy lifting too. And we want to really take on the biggest pain in the ass customers in the world. Mm. Right. Because that's what they're taking on, right? When you talk about what Bracket is going after here, you're taking on the hardest stuff to do. And if you can make plenty of money without doing that, why?
Yeah.
You're printing money as it is. Let these guys stay out there and be on premises. There's nothing that says that the cloud can't make oodles and oodles of money without having enterprise data.
Yeah. So they're going after the hardest part with the most anal customer set. Man, good luck to them on that.
Yeah, that's how I read it. Thanks for helping me figure that out.
You know, when I was saying I was falling asleep reading some of their blurb on their website. So this is the line or the two lines that kind of made me think, I'm either tired here or I don't understand this. But check this out, right? Bracket's patent pending Metavisor technology, okay, whatever that is.
Metavisor,
okay. Yeah, is core to running computing cell. Right. High performance micro virtualization. The Metavisor sits between the guest OS or container runtime and the cloud provider's hypervisor. Now, I'm like, I've done a fair amount on Amazon Web Services and a bit on Azure, and I just couldn't even get my head around how can they run in between the cloud provider's hypervisor and your guest OS. I mean, Amazon Web Services don't expose a hypervisor to me. They expose a guest OS. And I was just like, you know what? There's so many words in there, like Metavisor. I'm not even sure I grok what that is. And then they're talking about stuff that I can't get my head around. I'm like, oh, man.
Yeah, you know, Metavisor reminds me of middleware. You know, it sounds like middleware, and it's always hard to make a buck on middleware.
Well, there we go. That wraps up everything we've got for the week. I've just got one thing, actually, that I've just remembered. If anybody that's listening is going to DockerCon in Barcelona in, whatever that is, a month from now, I'm going to be there, and I'm going to maybe see if I can take some mobile recording equipment. So anybody who listens to the show, ping me, and we'll see if we can hook up while we're there, see if we can talk about anything interesting.
Oh, that should be very cool. You should try to figure out how to do a live show from there, even though none of us will be there. But
yeah, I did notice they just announced that DockerCon in the US next year is going to be in Seattle. I might see if I can get to that. I've never been to Seattle before.
Oh, you should go.
But yeah, I hear excellent things about it, actually.
Yeah. What time?
Next year, do you mean?
What time of the year do you think
it'll be? I think it's June, middle of June, something like okay. that.
Yeah, it'll probably be nice. It can still kind of be rainy up there, but with global warming going on or, you know, climate change, it's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous place in the summer. Really should go.
Cool. All right. Put it in the calendar. Pencil it in. You got anything else, Mark?
No, it's just that I hyper carbonated our last batch of beer. So now when we open it, you can pour half the bottle out and, you know, it gets a big foamy head on it. But
Didn't you spill it all over your desk before we recorded the special edition this week?
I did before on Monday, yeah, but I watched it. I opened up a large bottle today before recording this, and I poured about half of it out. And you just watch the bottle or the bubbles accumulate inside the bottle, and the next thing you know, it is running all over the counter. Uh-huh, it's like a super fluid. So just I'll just say this. So, you know, in the continuing saga for how to make better beer, we decided to over-carbonate instead of under-carbonate. And that's not necessarily successful either.
No, fair play. How long have you been doing this for now, Mark? Like, seriously?
Let's see. I guess I've been brewing beer with Tony for about a year and a half.
Yeah? How long's he been doing it for? Do you know?
Well, he started doing it in college, but it was a couple of years ago, actually, when he was on, the federal government shut down because he works at NASA. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he had some extra time on his hand. They were on furlough, right, to, you know, supposedly save money. What a joke that was. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll shut everything down. That'll save money. It ends up costing more money to do that. Stupid. Yeah. But anyway, so Tony had time on his hands, and he brewed beer again, right? And I didn't know he was doing it, but it was after a while. You know, we went over to their house and he said, "Hey, I made some beer. Do you want to try it?" And it's kind of like, "Yeah, I'll try your beer." And then it was, "Hey, Tony, this is pretty good beer." And then he says, "Why don't you help me make some?" Right? And I thought, "Okay, here we go." But then it's been, you know, now my new hobby.
Yeah. How much time do you spend on it in a week then?
I went into it kind of, you know, dragged in, you know, kind of not wanting to do it, but well, it depends on the week, right? It's just certain days. So when you're brewing up, you know, like an extract, you know, it really is like a 2.5 to 3 hour thing to, you know, start to finish to do that. But if you're going whole grain, all grain, it's 9 to 10 hours. But that was the way we were doing it. We had to brew two different batches, but we recently bought some larger equipment so we can do 10 gallons now, all in one batch, and that should shave 3 to 4 hours off.
I don't know if this is a cheeky question. How much money do you reckon you've sunk into this hobby so far?
Oh God, you know, I don't know.
Is it something that could end up costing a lot of money over the years? You know, is it because like. I just started playing golf with a bunch of friends, and it's not just the fees for playing and stuff, but it's like, oh, you know what? I fancy a new golf bag now. Whoa, some new clubs. Whoa, a few lessons. And before you know it, like my wife's starting to notice transactions on the bank account.
Yeah, so I figure, you know, just a rough swag, I probably spent in the area of $750 on it.
Yeah.
You know, which is not that much. I mean, I've picked up a lot of stuff on the cheap. The brewing kettle is stainless steel. That was one of the more expensive things. I got my burner stand from a friend of mine. I bought that. You know, we picked up our new mash tun. I picked up that used. I drove up to Oakland to get it. You know, so we Tony and I have kind of like this a little bit of a cheap approach to it. You know, so we've been trying to do it a little bit on the cheap. But you do buy the malt. The malt is always expensive, you know, so there's probably more than $750 in it, but I don't know. Mm-hmm.
And are you at a pretty good success rate for each of your batches these days, or do you get some duds still?
Well, we're getting a few. We still get some duds. I wouldn't call this IPA that's overcarbonated a dud. You just have to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just pours it a little bit funny. It tastes great though. It came out really well. We nailed the specific gravity on it, and it's really good. The thing we have right now that's going out, we need to bottle is a pumpkin spice beer, and we did that for the holidays, right? You know, coming up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a lot of ways to do it, and we could have put the pumpkin right in the mash. With the beer, but that the pumpkin stuff itself tends to clog up the tubes and everything that you're working with, and so we didn't do that. We just put spices, pumpkin pie spices, into the boil, and so that's been fermenting through a secondary fermentation right now. We're going to try to bottle it this weekend, and I'm not sure how that's going to turn out. I mean, I've been buying pumpkin flavored beers now for the last couple of weeks and drinking them, and you know, I'm not even sure why we made it because I'm not loving these pumpkin beers. You know, I'm just saying they're kind
it's
of
holidays, right?
It's the holidays. It's kind of interesting to have something else, but I'm starting to think it's going to be like pound cake, not pound cake, but what is that? Oh God! Oh, the stuff that you give away every Christmas season. Oh jeez, I can't even remember what it is.
American thing.
It is. Well, I know. I think you do it in the UK too, but you probably like it better there. Anyway.
All right.
Yeah. We'll see. Maybe I'll have bottles of the pumpkin beer forever. But we only made 5 gallons of it, though.